Donegal has some of the most beautiful gardens in the country and a rich tradition of garden making that stretches back to monastic times and spans the county from the Fannad Peninsula to Donegal Bay. But these gardens are much more than beautiful spaces. Behind neat hedges and through the flower borders hide 100 stories of our history, our garden making, and the magnificent obsessions that inspire people to make and maintain these Edens. My name is Mary Brophy, and I'm once again heading down the garden path to explore 6 more of Donegal's best-loved gardens. From a farmed landscape to private havens, in this second series, I'll be considering what it means to garden in a time of climate crisis and biodiversity loss.
You could actually smell the burning last year. I thought the geraniums would never come back again, you know, but they did.
And experience the stunning plants and trees that inhabit these spaces.
These are Scheffleras, so these are native to Taiwan. They're relatively new on the scene.
As I discover how we can create beautiful, productive spaces that work for both wildlife and people.
We have such little problems with pests. There is a balance. It's not a monoculture.
And how we might evolve our definition of what a garden is or can become.
Gardens can be absolutely anything your imagination wants them to be.
In our final episode in this series, I've come southwest of Rafoe to see not just a garden, but an entire landscape shaped and cultivated with biodiversity in mind.
We have crabapple, wild plum, wild cherry, wild rose and honeysuckle. So, you know, there's always another flower coming along in the hedge.
This is Carnone, the farm and vision of two of Donegal's most remarkable ecologists, Liz and Rafe Shepherd. It might sound strange, but I've come to walk the paths of their farm to explore ideas of what our gardens can be and how we might begin to reimagine them.
Just walk up and start in the field.
Liz and Rafe are first bringing me to what was once a potato field on the farm. But planted 40 years ago, it has transformed into a native woodland, managed to maximise biodiversity. We're walking through a recently cut silage meadow.
This field that we're walking through is the one with all the old grasses in it, because it's never been ploughed up, and it's cut for silage twice a year, and it's grazed lightly in the winter now and again. But there's about 10 or 12 different grass species here, and the one we really like is the Yorkshire fog, the lovely pinky one, but unfortunately it all got cut 2 days ago. So you can see the remains of our path that we cut through the long grass on the way up here.
One of the main reasons that we keep the field as it is that we have a colony of special moths called ghost moths. Okay. They come out at dusk and they're white, and they quiver their wings very rapidly in this sort of stationary flight, and as the light fades they are very ghost-like, and their larvae feed on the roots of grasses, and there's a colony in this field that builds up through June to a peak in midsummer, and normally an early silage cut would scupper them.
Yes.
But our friend postpones his first cut until the ghost moths have had their season. And that's great.
And it often coincides with the June full moon. So, and you've got to come out at about 10 to 11 or that kind of around 11 o'clock they come out. You know, in the middle of June, it's very twilighty at that stage, and the whole field can be fluttering white.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Now, they did crash for a year or two, but they're back again this year, so we're very pleased about that.
That's great.
We're coming into a plantation that we planted in 1990. So it's now, what, 32 years old?
Well, we did the plantations at 10-year intervals, so we have one planted in 1980, 1990, 2000 and 2010. So this is the second one, and it's really developed into a good woodland by this stage.
The plantation includes oak, ash, alder and birch, with smaller numbers of rowan and Scots pine.
The path going off to the right was carved through the trees as a sort of secondary path, and we'll walk that way. It's narrower than the other ones, and it's more windy. And
underfoot as we walk, Rafe, there's just this lovely little peppering of mushrooms starting to come up on the forest floor.
Yep. Yeah,
mostly puffballs at this time of year. But we, in some years, we have a wonderful variety of mushrooms. I think this year's going to be quite good. It's been a remarkable year in many ways, an unusual year. Yeah. And obviously climate change has some pluses and some minuses.
Yeah.
For instance, the insect population, we monitor the butterfly population around the farm and the bumblebees. And this year and last year, we've noticed a big decline in species numbers.
We're walking over the carpet of little round leaves. That's a plant called golden saxifrage.
This little guy?
Yes.
It's almost like a mint leaf. It's exactly
like that. But in early spring, the flowers are a bright golden yellow, they just light up the plantation because they're here in bulk. And it is just glorious walking through these paths at that time, before any other leaves are on the trees, and everything looks dead. This glow comes from the path.
Wow, that's beautiful. And given this was a potato field, did these all just appear? I mean, right now as we walk through...
Everything here has come in since...
Just amazing where stuff comes from, you know.
Like we're brushing past beautiful big ferns here as we walk through.
Yes, they all came in.
All sorts of different species of ferns. This is a male fern. And this is a broad buckler. You can see the difference in the fronds. So we have got about a dozen different species in the plantation, and they've all come in since.
You said this is over 30 years old. Mm-hmm. What kind of, like, would you have thinned this many times since? How is it managed?
Yes, we use something close to what they call the continuous cover system on the continent. So instead of thinning twice in the lifetime of the trees and then cutting them all down, which is the conventional method, we nibble at this plantation every couple of years. We only take out the trees that need to be taken out. And we favour the best trees. So the good trees remain, the bad trees are removed. And as this system proceeds, you eventually end up with trees reaching their natural maturity, which is a couple of hundred years rather than 30 years. And you'll get really, hopefully, huge oak trees. If you decide for commercial reasons you want to fell a particular oak tree at 200 years old, there'll be one that's 180 years old sitting beside it waiting for its moment in the sun. So the canopy remains. It's so much better for timber production and for biodiversity, because you don't set the biodiversity back to zero after 30 years. It keeps on developing.
Why is it so particularly good for biodiversity?
For a start, the soil continues to develop. The mycorrhizal fungi that support all the trees and other plants as well, it gets a chance to develop.
And spread. Okay.
So there is a whole network of life that is intertwined. And also you get a bigger diversity of niches. If you're simply growing Sitka spruce straight up for 30 years and then back down to zero. It's homogeneous. But here you've got little patches of oak trees, you've got isolated rowans, you've got little glades where you removed two or three trees maybe and there's more light coming in. So there's a huge diversity of niches that different plants and different animals can exploit. And that continues to develop vertically as well as horizontally. As the trees get bigger and older, they will create more niches. So when, for example, some trees die off, as has happened with alder in particular, for natural reasons, it's not a problem.
Yeah.
We leave the trees standing.
Okay.
So we have got, if you like, great spotted woodpecker nest boxes all over the place. Because that's exactly what they want. They want dead trees.
And are they here?
No, they're not here, okay. But we're waiting for them.
Okay.
Each tree species in this small woodland is its own habitat, attracting particular wildlife to it. As Rafe tells me, the Scots pine, for instance, attracts particular moth species. The dwarf pug, the bordered white, and the red-necked footman, only present here because of conifers, and the Scots pine in particular.
It's just part of the crumbling of what you might call nature's signature. Every patch of land has got a signature that is unique to it, which is the network of species of plants and animals that have evolved to be there together.
Yeah.
And that is breaking down all over the world. And in Ireland, there is no patch of land that you could regard as truly natural. We've messed them all up.
Mm.
There are some that are more natural than others,
yeah.
And there is a lot that we can do to kind of restore that balance by planting native trees rather than aliens, and seeing what happens if they're given a chance to survive into the future.
But even taking that back right down to, say, a garden level and a domestic level, like where somebody doesn't have a huge amount of space, a hawthorn hedge then could be far more interesting and better than a cherry laurel, for instance.
Oh, or 100%. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You'll see when we get down to the garden some of the things that we have done that help our garden to contribute to restoring nature.
When we're thinning the trees, we cut off all the small twigs and pile them up into piles, which become a great habitat in itself. And twice I've watched a stoat weaving in and out of a pile of what we call brash, the brushwood from the trees. You know how stoats love to go in and out of a stone wall?
Yes.
Well, they were using the... We don't have a stone wall anywhere near, so they were using these piles of sticks as their hunting ground.
That's a rion that came down in the storm.
These woodlands clearly mean so much to Rafe and Liz. They're a source of beauty and curiosity in equal measure. And also something else that many gardeners will recognise.
When you step through the gate into the plantation, it feels as if your blood pressure is dropping.
Yeah.
Whether that's true or not's another matter, but that's what it feels like. And it may be something to do with the chemicals that are given off from the soil.
Yeah.
There's quite probably a sort of hard scientific explanation, but it's not a hard scientific experience. It's a very emotional one.
Yes.
Look at we've just walked past a group of puffball mushrooms that are not quite ready to puff.
There's one that might puff.
Yeah. Oh. It absolutely did.
Yeah.
And more is being discovered about the interrelationship of trees under the ground through the mycelium of the mushrooms.
In a way, it kind of strikes me that you're almost seeing this landscape and this place in multi dimensions, that you're seeing up, you're seeing out, and you're seeing down also.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, when you think about the mushrooms, there's an interesting statistic, which is that the roots of a mature oak tree, laid end to end, would stretch for something like 5 kilometers. The mycorrhizal fungi, or fungal threads that are attached to those roots, would go around the earth.
In today's final episode of this series of Down the Garden Path, I'm at Carinone House and Farm with Liz and Rafe Shepherd to explore how gardens can become mini landscapes for nature. We're heading back from a woodland through the silage meadow, with tall mature hedges flanking our way.
We both do regular transects. I do transect for bumblebees, and Liz does one for butterflies.
Okay. What's a transect now, to be honest?
Well, a transect is a set route, okay, that you repeat again and again, so that over the years you can detect a change in the numbers.
I've been doing it, the butterflies, now for about 14 years. So it's actually very interesting to see. I mean, we don't have very rare butterflies here, but it's the population,
okay,
and the ups and downs of it, and how it's affected by the weather from year to year.
And are you seeing a trajectory downward?
There's been ups and downs, but it's a slow decline.
Really?
And particularly in some species, like the green-veined white. In a good year in this nice grassy field, you would have you would have flickering white butterflies,
yes,
all over the place. Now you would only count about 30, maybe, when you would have had 200 before.
As Liz explains, inadequate nutrition is a major cause of pollinator decline. They simply don't have enough food throughout the year.
The buddleia is the big thing for those vanescent butterflies, the peacocks, red admirals, small tortoiseshells.
As we make our way back toward the house, Liz points out buddleia the couple planted in the hedge line for butterflies.
See the rose bay willow herb?
I do, yes.
It's wonderful.
Complemented underneath by the pretty pink of a small stand of willow herb, thrumming with bees.
So we're just coming in under into one of the woodsheds here, and Rafe, you're placing down a large black barrel, very strange looking object, with a lot of egg boxes in it. And what is this?
This is a moth trap.
Last night, Rafe set out a moth trap so that I can see for myself just a few of the over 400 incredible species of moth he's recorded here at Carinone through the years.
That one that just flown was a dark marbled carpet, and this is a common market marbled carpet. Carpets are moths that have patterns on their closed wings that reminded the people a few centuries back of sort of Persian carpets. So the group as a whole are called the carpets. This is this one here, looking up from the hole in the egg box with a green line around it, is
he's here still. Going onto the ground here.
He's a lesser, he's got a very long name for a relatively small moth. Lesser broad bordered yellow underwing.
And there's a beautiful little yellow one just here.
Yeah, that's called a small wainscot. The names are rather amazing.
They're fascinating.
The people who named them in the old days, they had the most amazing associations. That one, the name is obvious. It's called the brimstone moth.
Look at it.
Because it is brimstone yellow.
Absolutely. That is beautiful now.
It is a lovely thing.
Is that rare? Is that?
No, it's very common.
It's very common.
But because it only comes out at night, nobody knows it's here.
Liz and Rafe have kept incredible records of the decades of their time here. Paying close attention, they are intimately familiar with every habitat that exists, Every wildflower, lichen, bumblebee, dragonfly, moth and mammal with which they share this Donegal landscape. But their records also clearly indicate a stark reality.
A lot of the species that I used to get either occasionally or in some cases commonly in the early years, say the 1990s, are now quite rare. Other species have colonized, which I like to think is because of the improvement in the habitat.
Leave it open so they can escape.
Yeah, I'll leave it open a little bit. Yeah, so I'm losing my interpretation is that I'm losing moths in terms of both numbers and in terms of species to the general deterioration of the overall environment. And I'm gaining others because I've improved the habitat. In Britain, many, many species have gone down like stones over the last 20 years. 95% reduction in many, many species.
We're just coming around to the house now, and we've come into the front garden here. Just as we came through the garden gate, there is a large amount of ivy side of the wall.
I was going to talk about that because ivy is so special.
Yeah.
You can see it's just coming into flower now, against all other normal procedures. It's coming into flower at this time of year. So it's very good for late pollinators. We sometimes see red admirals on it, but a lot of little flies and smaller pollinators. And then, you know, later on, November, December, even into January, they're covered with little black fruits. And you often find the blackbirds and thrushes feasting on them when there's nothing else. So because it does its thing at such an odd time, it is really valuable. Also for its shelter and nesting and roosting, it's just a brilliant thing. So I would encourage everybody to keep some ivy.
So talk to me now. This is your garden. And you, every time I mention garden, you laugh and it's like, well, we don't garden.
Well, as you can see, there's a lot of wildness around. This large lawn, when I was a child, was a croquet lawn. It was like a billiard table. And in fact, we've kept it mowed up until 3 summers ago when we just decided to let it go and see what happened. And we put the paths in so that our neighbours don't think we've gone completely mad.
It was a succession of wildflowers all through the summer. So we start in spring with speedwells, creeping speedwell and germander speedwell. And then we have buttercups and dandelion. And then we have the white clover.
Yeah.
And then finally we have a long season of birdsfoot trefoil. Mm. All these beautiful, colourful wildflowers that are pollinators for the insects. And through it all there were the tall grasses flowering, and it was just delightful.
A lot of what I'm finding in this series and thinking about is that not just thinking of a garden as somewhere that you get pleasure and an aesthetic, because that's almost something you look at, but that thinking of it as a living thing that is alive with other life and what's good for them. Do you also feel that it's, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and is it a way of seeing? Is it changing how you see landscape or environment?
Absolutely. I mean, all through the summer, we would walk these little paths through the lawn every day, looking to see what new flower has appeared that we haven't planted. Gardens can be absolutely anything your imagination wants them to be.
Down the Garden Path is written and presented by Mary Brophy and produced by Neil Boyle. It is an IWR media production for Highland Radio, funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.